So I'll start by reciting a poem by Czesław Miłosz. He's a Polish poet. Love means to learn to look at yourself the way one looks at distant things, for you are only one thing among many, and whoever feels this way heals his heart without knowing it from various ills. A bird and a tree say to him, friend. Then he learns to use himself and things so that they stand in the glow of ripeness. It doesn't matter whether he knows what he serves. Who serves best doesn't always understand. So Czesław Miłosz wrote that in Warsaw just after the Second World War. So perhaps he knew, he'd tested his love in the fires of war and knew what it meant. So I'm very pleased that we're doing this theme on Meta for our Young Women's Weekend, because it's very simple, the theme of Meta, but extremely profound. And I think the more I practice the Dharma, the more I realise I'll never get to the bottom of Meta. I'll never get to the depths of Meta, what it really means. And I had a dream once, the night I took up the Padmasambhava practice, sadhana practice, and I had this dream that I was going down this corridor with lots of closed doors, and one of the doors was open, and I went in the open door, and there was Bhante Sangharakshita sitting in meditation posture with an enormous red lotus made out of light suspended in the air in front of him. And he was just contemplating this red lotus. It was almost like there was a communication going on between the red lotus and Bhante. And I stood at the door and watched him. And what I realized at that moment is that I didn't really know what the red lotus meant, but I knew that Bhante did. And that was enough for me. And I realized also at that time that I would spend the rest of my life trying to understand what metta really is. And I've kept to that so far. So to develop metta means that we really have to join it with wisdom right from the beginning of our practice. Otherwise, necessarily, our metta will be limited. We'll always succumb to the gravitational pull of the self and the tyranny of self-demands, the sort of tyranny of me-itis. When I was little, if we were having a little strop about something, my friend's mum, she always used to say, oh dear, I think you've got a little case of me-itis today, haven't you? Well, I think we've all got a big, ginormous case of me-itis. It's called samsara. And what we do with this kind of constant self-referencing is it's actually very painful and unpleasant to experience. But also it means that we relate to the whole world in terms of our self-grasping, what we can get out of it personally. And we relate in the same way to our metta bhavana practice. So Bhante describes metta, he says it's a bit like we've sort of launched the satellite of metta. The satellite of love goes out into the air. But it never breaks free of the self. In the end, what we do is we settle down into a comfortable orbit around the self. So we get so far with our metta, and it's a wonderful thing to shoot that rocket off into space, but it ends up going so far and no further. It just ends up in this comfortable orbit around the self. And for me, I need something more than that. I need something limitless in order for me to be interested in it. I think that's partly to do with my personality as well. I seem to have this enormous sense of life, in my own being and life going on around me. And I wake up in the morning and, generally speaking, I just feel on fire with life. And then I don't quite know what to do with it. How do I shape my existence? What do I do with this thing called existence that is in my hand? And I feel this very, very strongly. So for me to be interested in something, I have to see its limitless potential. It's not enough for me to make my decisions about what I do with my life based on being nicer. It's just not going to cut it for someone who wakes up with an existential feeling of life every morning. Well, what you do with life is be a nicer person. Because, of course, it'll take, if we see meta as just to do with becoming a nicer person, we'll get so far and it'll make us feel very good, but our meta will be dependent on conditions. It will be dependent on getting enough sleep, having a good meditation space with no noise around, and everyone being friendly to us. So it's important that we set up conditions for metta to rise, but also to make our metta practice independent of conditions. And speaking personally as well, I think this is also very important to me. When I was 10 years old, I suddenly had a realization of my own capacity for ill will and violence. And I realized through a series of events that were very real and present in my life, that I would be capable of killing someone. I'd be capable of killing someone if they hurt my family. And I knew at that stage that that wasn't okay, that actually I had to really, really develop a love that was greater than this sort of self-protection, that wasn't dependent on conditions. And so I was a slightly strange, intense 10-year-old, it's got to be said. But anyway, so I got all these books about all these people who've kind of managed to maintain, well, their metta, I didn't know it was called metta then, but their love throughout very, very demanding situations, you know, through kind of concentration camps and all this poverty and suffering and things like that. And it was very important to me that actually I managed to make my practice of love, or that I could, was able to cultivate love that was stronger than my own ill will. And also I was quite angry. So I needed something that was bigger. Basically, it was bigger than me and bigger than even as far as my imagination can take it. The Mahayana expresses this poetically as Mahayana being some of the later schools of Buddhism. They express it poetically that Maitri, or which is the Sanskrit word for metta, which is Pali, metta or Maitri has to pass through the fires of shunyata, of emptiness. So what they mean by that, emptiness is another word in a sense for wisdom. And it's not just that everything is empty per se. It's empty of Atman. It's empty of a belief in a fixed, enduring, separate selfhood. So metta has to pass through the fires of shunyata. It has to pass through the fires of shunyata to enable it to break through the delusion of a fixed, inherent, separate selfhood. And in a way, that is making the metta bhavana practice a practice of insight, or merging metta with wisdom. I have to say, I really dislike the word insight, but I'll say it anyway because it seems to be very popular. So I'll say it, insight. Ooh. I think the thing with insight is it's too easy to sort of think of it as your insight. I've got insight, which is a contradiction in terms, because of obviously insight is passing through the fire of shunyata. It's passing through away from the delusion of a fixed separate selfhood. So there's no question of me getting any insight. Anyway. So yes, so to pass through the fires of shunyata, to pass our metta through the fires of shunyata, we realize that we are not fixed and we are not separate. We're not separate from others, we're not separate from the world. One way we could look at it is Bhante wrote a wonderful poem called Life is King. And in that he said, life does not belong to us, we belong to life. Life is king. So in a way, you could look at that particular realization as that we belong to life. We are not separate, we are not fixed. Everything is always changing. And I think the main point of seeing metta as what happens when you pass through those fires of shunyata, through the fires of wisdom, is that we can tend to think of insight or wisdom as personal. That's very much to do with the Western psyche as well, sort of consumerist attitude to Buddhist practice is seeing it as my individual possession. You know, if I've got enough money, I'll get a car. If I've got enough wisdom, I'll get insight. And and actually, where was I going with that? Oh yes, so we tend to think of insight as something quite kind of cold, intellectual, individual that we can own. and that means that we don't have to make a commitment to change our lives. So we can remain fairly emotionally detached and don't have to make a commitment. And in a way, that's the Western psyche for you. Particularly the British psyche. Anyway, we like to remain emotionally detached and free of commitment. So then we tend to think of insight as something quite cold, about just going beyond the self or spiritual death or getting rid of the ego. But of course, once you realise that you're not fixed or separate, it doesn't leave you in a cold and blank, featureless state. And this is the point Subhuti makes in his recent paper that he wrote called The Suprapersonal Force. He says, well, it's not that you enter into this cold, detached, featureless state. Actually, insight has its own positive character. And that its own positive character is an increasing awareness of others and spontaneous compassionate activity. That's what insight is. It's spontaneous compassionate activity. You can't sort of separate it out. So a big question for me is how to make my metta pass through the fires of shunyata, pass through the fires of wisdom. And luckily for us, the Buddhist tradition has a way of exploring this, particularly found in a Mahayana or later Buddhist sutra called the Akshayamati Nidesha. So I've been reflecting on these for a number of years, actually. I sort of dug out my old talks on this particular subject and I realised that I changed my mind every time. And it's been going on for about, I don't know, maybe about 6 years. So, yeah, so the Akshayamati Nidesha sort of points a way about, it's a way, it's not quite like there's stages of metta. It's almost like different movements of metta, or how metta progresses towards insight, towards enlightenment, towards wisdom. And what it asks us to do is to take, to look much more deeply into the nature of other, much more deeply into the nature of other people. And of course, this is the great mystery. The great mystery in our lives is not what happens in space or with the atom or modern physics. The great mystery is, can I sit in the same room as another person and actually talk to them? You know, that's the great mystery. What is going on for another person? And another way we could look at it is, Sangharakshita talks about this, that in a way, wisdom is going beyond the distinction between self and other. And in order to do that, you have to penetrate deeply into the nature of self and other. So there are some practices which enable us to look deeply into the nature of self, which has its uses. But also we have been looking into our own nature for quite a number of aeons and lifetimes. And sometimes, you know, there can be a little too much emphasis on self. So maybe we should try and sort of have the other approach, which is also looking deeply into the nature of other and self. So this is what the Akshayamati Sutra does. Nidesha does it. It is a way to look deeply into the nature of other people and of self in order to break down those distinctions. So it's got three. There's sort of three phases, if you like. And the first phase is metta with sentient beings as its object. Metta with sentient beings as its object. Bhante does briefly touch on these in his book or seminar on called Wisdom Beyond Words. And in that he says you start off with a common sense approach based on a perception of yourself and others as distinct and palpable egos. Common sense approach based on a perception of yourself and others as distinct and palpable egos. So basically, to kind of chunk this down a bit, the first level of metta as a wisdom practice is that we're actually aware that other human beings exist. We're actually aware that other human beings exist as independent of our own likes and dislikes. There is actually a person there. So most of the time, we're so caught up with ourselves and our own sort of likes and dislikes and things going on bubbling away in our consciousness that we forget that there's other people We forget there's other people and we think that we're the only people in the universe. I particularly find this happens if any kind of food queue. I can be really metaphor, and then it gets to that where there's just that demand, and I really struggle with not just pushing people out the way. Anyway, there you go. There's me starting off with a, yeah, and kind of concentration camps and torture and still having love for people. If I could just start with a dinner queue, I'd be doing quite well. So yes, we see people in terms of our own responses. What's their effect on me? And we think about our own responses to them, but we don't consider that maybe they're having their own responses to us. So I think this goes along with the basic wrong view that actions don't have consequences, that we don't have an effect on other people. So, you know, if I go around stomping around in a bad mood, slamming drawers and, I don't know, pots and pans, it doesn't matter. But on the same side, I think we can get into this wrong view in a way from the more positive side, that we think that if we're friendly to people, if we go out to people, if we have generous acts towards other people, we think that that doesn't matter. It doesn't count. So I think the first stage is realizing that we do have an effect on other people. Other people have just as much as other people have an effect on us. And that we start directing our meta towards someone else, actually focusing on someone else, that they come into focus as a human being. We recognize that other people exist in their own right. So the way the Tibetans put this is that other people exist from their own side. They're not just a kind of hanger for your own projections and likes and dislikes. They exist. They've got their own consciousness, their own life going on. So the first stage of making metta an insight practice is to have a dual focus of subject and object. So we're aware of others as human beings at the same time as being aware of ourselves as human beings. There's two people there. There's a dual focus. So in other words, we see others as objects, but those objects, those other people who exist in their own right, see themselves as subjects and us as objects. So actually, I found this quote, and I can't remember from where it's from. I think it's from Living with Kindness, where Bhante says, "Only when one becomes aware that other people are subjects as well as objects, and that from their point of view, one is oneself an object rather than a subject, can true communication take place." It might help to actually understand that sentence as well. But you kind of get the gist, you know, you're in your subjectivity looking at them as an object, and they're in their subjectivity looking at you as an object. And that's what's going on. And that's why we use the phrases. In a way, I see the phrases as, I know some of the groups have talked about phrases and whether you use them or not. I think they're very helpful. Because I think what they do is they allow us a kind of bridge of imagination, a bridge of imaginative identification. Because just as much as we are living our own lives in our own subjectivity, they're living their lives in their own subjectivity. Just as we want to be well and happy and free from suffering, just as we want to progress, so they want to be well and happy and free from suffering, and they want to progress. So I think the first stage is that we actually have to look at each other to see others independently of whether they make us feel good or whether they make us feel uncomfortable. We actually have to try and enter into each other's world, take an interest in each other as people. You know, just try and play around like they exist. They've got their own lives just as we do. Just as I think I'm the centre of the universe, you're all sitting there thinking that you're all centres of the universe. And try and kind of promote that imaginative identification. So this is a test from people from Sheffield. Love is no mere flabby sentiment, but the vigorous expression of an imaginative identification with other living beings. Well done. And where's that quote from?
Ten Pillars.
Ten Pillars. Oh, okay. So, yeah, so that's what Sangharakshita says in the Ten Pillars. Love is no mere flabby sentiment, but the vigorous expression of an imaginative identification with other living beings. You know, there's a power in that. If you really enter into it, someone else's world, you're breaking the bonds of delusion. You're doing something quite radical. You're realizing that someone exists from their own side. Independent of your own projections. And that is quite a task. That's quite a radical thing to do. That's not a flabby niceness. That's really breaking the bonds of delusion. So in that poem that I quoted at the beginning, he says, love means to learn to look at yourself the way one looks at distant things, for you are only one thing among many. So this is what this is really working with. You are only one thing among many. Well, not even only. You're a very special thing, but you are one thing among many things. And whoever feels this way heals his heart without knowing it from various ills. I think this is the other side of it. I know myself that sometimes I can get sort of into, you know, just very negative mental states, sometimes quite kind of torturous mental states. And I remember when I was working in the evolution shop in Sheffield, and they used to call me the vortex of darkness because I got into these such dreadful moods. It was almost like, you know, you could sort of, it was a bit like some horror movie, and the whole shop would be going and this kind of cloud. And basically I had to take on a precept of just walking around the block and just take that cloud outside. So I just have to go, I'm really sorry, and then put things on. And I remember walking around the block once, and I was in such a terrible mood, and I just opened the door for someone else. And in that moment, the whole thing crumbled. And the whole thing crumbled because I was just one thing among many. And I stopped being so sort of in my own head, you know, this sort of vibrating negativity in my own head. I just realised that another human being existed, and that was enough to break me out of it. And I think I learned a lot from that, actually, that, you know, what Dada Rinpoche said was, well, when in doubt, do something for someone else. And it's very good advice if you're all kind of in your own sticky mental states or whatever, just do something for someone else. And it sort of breaks out. Without knowing it, you heal yourself from various ills. A bird and a tree say to him, friend. Somehow you're sort of linked again with the universe. There are the birds, there are the trees. Because we all know that in those negative mental states, it's very hard to maintain that broad awareness of other people and of life going on in its own business. So sometimes if we just reach out to someone else, it breaks that pattern. We break that delusion, and somehow again we're linked again with the universe. There are birds, there are trees, there are other people. We are just one thing among many. So I suppose the practical point for that first stage is it's very important in the metta bhavana to watch how you bring other people to mind. Sometimes people say to me, well, I find the metta bhavana very, very difficult because I just can't seem to generate any emotion. And, you know, maybe I'm just this sort of desert of emotion. Maybe I'm a dried up prune of a being. Actually, no one's ever said that to me. But anyway, you get the gist. Prunes. We can all feel like little dried up prunes. And I say to them, well, okay, so someone was sitting in front of you crying. Would you have an emotional response to that person? Well, yeah, of course. If someone was sitting in front of me crying, I would. And in a way, well, the metta bhavana is no different then. It's the main question, at the least initially, is to actually get a sense of a real human being in front of you. And of course, if there's a real human being in front of you, you'll have an emotional response to them. But most of the time what happens is it's very difficult in the metta bhavana to get a sense of someone there. You know, we sort of sit down, right, okay, think of a person, right, think of a person, may they be well, may they be happy for yourself, and well, where are they? There's no one there. So of course you haven't got any emotion towards them because they're not there. Or it sometimes happens at the first stage, you know, you're just like, right, okay. But where are you? You know, what is actually going on? So that's why it's very important to do a body scan, really get in touch with how you actually are and have a real person. And notice how you bring people to mind. We'll do a bit of work on that in a minute. But it's very important to notice how you bring people to mind, to really evoke someone in your imagination. Even if you spent all the metta bhavana just doing that, evoking someone, you know, saying their name again and again. In a way, you're kind of calling them forth in your imagination. Yes, and also keeping a subjective focus, particularly keeping an awareness in your body, because it stops you from going off into a fantasy about the other person and kind of roots you into a real emotional connection with them. Because otherwise you can end up trying to sort of squeeze out an emotion that isn't there. Well, we're not trying to do that. If you're going to have an imaginative identification with someone else, you've also got to know how you are. You've got to know what you feel in order to know what other people feel. You know, a bit like, you know, sometimes that happens, even if you're feeling, for example, strong grief or sadness or something like that. Sometimes you can, that actually in those times you feel more connected with other people because the experience is so vivid in your mind that you suddenly realize what it's like for other people. So in order to have an imaginative identification with other people, we really need to get in touch with our own emotions and see that all people experience these emotions at some time. But in a way, we can't skip that step. We can't skip the step of actually seeing how we are in order to know what it's like for another human being. So this is where most of the work is in the metta bhavana, this dual focus of keeping a sense of oneself, bringing oneself into focus, and also bringing another human being into focus, that they are not fundamentally different from you. However, this stage is still limited, so it's the stage that Subhuti calls a rational self-interest. So we've still got a palpable sense of me and you as separate, self and other. And you're making an imaginative identification with that other human being, but you've still got a sense of separate, palpable egos. So even though we're beginning to bring into being awareness of another human being, we're still doing so in order for me to cultivate metta towards them. So there's still that sort of, a dual focus. I am going to cultivate metta towards you. So you've still got a sense of separation, a sense of separate palpable egos. So the second stage of metta, Maitri, is Maitri with truth as its object. And Bhante says about this stage, next you refine your view of things so that you see them as all as mere composites of dharmas. So dharmas in this context means phenomena. And phenomena is characterized by being not fixed and not separate. So basically what we do in this stage is we reflect that all beings are changing all the time, including ourselves. All beings are changing all the time. You could look at this on a physical level, seeing that people's bodies are changing. Even though we're young, it's still starting to happen right now. Our bodies are changing. And that process might be not so quick. But we can definitely see it in our minds, that our minds are changing all the time. It's not just that we're getting older, it's also that we can just go through all realms in one day. We can go through all realms in 1 hour. We can go through all the seasons in 1 hour. We can see that our minds just turn again and again and again and again. Constant fluid process of mind. That's particularly what we see in meditation, you know. Having quite a good time, having nice quiet meditation and feeling very positive, and then someone makes a little bit of noise and then suddenly our mental states change. So it's looking at this, it's seeing that everything is in a process of change. Physical and mental phenomena are in a process of change. But also seeing that that change isn't random. That change is dependent upon conditions. So it's not that there are kind of separate beings changing in a vortex. I think sometimes we can think of ourselves and others a bit like ping pong balls. Not ping pong balls, those little metal balls in a ping pong machine. Do you remember those? You know, pinball, that's it, pinball machines. And I used to love playing pinball machines when I was younger. And it's like that. So we're all kind of going rolling around the universe and occasionally colliding and occasionally coming together in a happy way. but basically, we're fundamentally just rolling around the universe, sort of separated and isolated. Well, actually, the mind is not separated from the body. And all of it is coming into being all the time. There's a kind of web of becoming, or a web of process happening all the time. Nothing is fixed, nothing is separate. So in this stage, in a way, what we're doing is we're focusing a bit more on process rather than content. So we're seeing that the universe is process. We are process. We watch our mind as process. We see other people as process. Not denying the content and taking an interest in the content, but also seeing that actually it's fluid, it's always changing, and it's dependent on conditions. And from that point of view, you kind of get to this stage where the whole idea of me sending metta to you is fundamentally odd. That's the only way I can describe it. There's an experience of oddness that I would be here sending metta to you, because actually this core of the self that I send metta from is an idea. It's just an idea. My own fixed and separate selfhood is just an idea, which is useful but not particularly real. And actually, it's an attempt to pin down something much, much more fluid. So my whole idea of myself and my whole idea of you is trying to pin down something that's actually much, much more fluid and coming into being all the time in every moment. So the way that Bhante describes this, he says, for Buddhism, no less than for modern physics and psychology, all the apparent stable and solid material and mental objects in the universe are in reality temporary condensations of energy, which can be locked up in the atom in the one case and trapped in the individual mind in the other. So this is the sort of second stage of this metta, that you see that all the apparently stable and solid material and mental objects in the universe are in reality temporary condensations of energy. So your vision of how the world is, your vision of self, your vision of others becomes loose. It sort of becomes more fluid, more changeable. So beings are always changing. They're changing in their mind, they're changing in their body. Each moment is a crystallization of conditions that give rise to unique and precious human beings in every moment. Everything is a crystallization of conditions that give rise to the uniqueness of the moment. And I think what this really means in my experience is if we really take in impermanence and interconnectedness or non-separateness, what it leads to is an awareness of beauty. So I think one of the things about nature and music is that they're beautiful because they're impermanent. If we always had a kind of amazing sunset just out there, you know, you just cease to notice it. It's like why a rainbow is so very, very exciting, because you know it's going to finish. So you really enjoy it while it lasts. If the sky was just permanently filled with rainbows, it's just part of life, isn't it? And the same with music. What makes music beautiful is its sort of changing nature, that you're not holding one note still. If you just held one note still, it would just be a drone, which is not very beautiful. And in the same way, I think we have to learn to look at human beings as beautiful and delight in them. And this is what this stage is really all about. Seeing people other beings as impermanent, seeing ourselves as impermanent, is also seeing them as beautiful. There's a strong link between metta, the quality of metta or maitri, and vidya, which means wisdom, but it means a particular kind of wisdom. It means aesthetic appreciation. Metta, it's said in the traditional Buddhist texts, in the Pali Canon, it says that metta leads to a state called the liberation of the beautiful. And it's worth reflecting on that. Why would metta lead to a state called the liberation of the beautiful and not just the liberation of metta? Well, I think what happens is in that stage of metta, when we see that all beings are changing independent upon conditions, and we are changing independent upon conditions, and we're not fixed and we're not separate, what happens then is that we appreciate things without wanting to own or have them, without using them to just construct our own self-identity. Because I think a lot of the time we can end up in a position with other people that we kind of want them, and we want them to kind of build a sense of who we are. So, you know, I am the kind of person that likes this person but doesn't like that person. I like these kind of people and I don't like these kind of people. And in that kind of project, what we're doing is we're creating a self-identity. But in this stage of metta, when you see yourself as fluid and other people as fluid, there's no attempt to kind of construct an identity out of someone else. And what happens then is we just appreciate them for their own sake. So the way Bhante talks about this is he says, if you look with craving, you see things in terms of sensuous attractiveness. But if you look with metta, you see things in terms of beauty. Metta is disinterested. When it's a question of lust, you want to grab. When it's a question of aesthetic appreciation, you just want to stand back and contemplate. I think this is why it's very important that we develop our friendships and not just our sexual relationships, because it's easier to have metta towards a friend because you don't want to own them in any way, or you don't want to grab them in any way, hopefully. Maybe in a playful punch, but not in that sticky sort of a way. So that's not my note, so I'm going off on one again. So it's that. And you can really get a sense of that in the Metta Bhavana, where actually you can get a real sense of someone's just beauty. And that beauty comes about in their just changing and unique and mysterious nature. You don't want anything from them. You just want to stand back and contemplate. And you're able to stand back and contemplate because you're not fixing them. And you're seeing them as just this sort of amazing crystallization of conditions. And they're not fixed. They're not separate. They're always changing. You haven't got them summed up. You don't know what you're talking about in relation to them. Your whole stories are just your stories. But actually here is a human being that's vivid and bright and changing. And you see other people in all their effort, with their whole burden of creating their life. You see them in their changing moods, you see them in their beautiful moments, you see them in their ugly moments. You see that they're not separate, that they're always conditioning their environment and their world around them, but their environment and the world around them is also conditioning them. And I think we can get this also if we have friendships over a long period of time and we stick with them through thick and thin. You see that changing nature of your friend. And even when they're ugly, they become beautiful. So I remember once actually someone, I had this experience when someone was having a real go at me, and it was totally unjustified as well, which is anyone who's training for ordination, get used to it. So she was just having a go at me, and it was about something. And in a way she was, you know, she was really brimming over with hatred and really having a pop. And in a way she looked really ugly and she was crying and everything. But in a sense, I just got this enormous sense of beauty because I could just see she was just struggling with life. And I think part of it was I just didn't take it at all personally. It was just nothing to do with me. But what I could see was just this human being struggling with life, trying to create their existence in that moment. And I got this enormous sense of sort of beauty and connectedness with her. And then I started to cry for completely different reasons. There we go. And this very much ties in with, for me anyway, with the three knowledges of the Buddha. So these are the three knowledges that the Buddha had when he became enlightened, which I've been reflecting on recently, particularly having gone to Bodh Gaya and sitting underneath the Bodhi tree. And just reflecting on the Buddha, what the content of the Buddha's enlightenment was. And the second knowledge, or the second vision that he had, actually, it was a vision that he had on his enlightenment, was he saw a vision of all beings coming in and out of existence, their lives determined by the effects of their actions. So it's quite a thing. I mean, that the language in the text is quite terse and brief, but if you really get a sense of this, there was the Buddha sitting under the tree, seeing beings throughout space and time coming in and out of existence in one great direct flush of reality. Beings coming in and out of existence and seeing how they're shaping their own lives all the time, this great kind of flux of humanity all the time. And not only did he see this, he saw that one could be free of suffering. He saw how human existences were bound up with suffering and how they could be free. And he knew how they could be free because he knew himself was freed. And what a positive vision to see all beings as they are, no kind of hiding from it, no hidden corners of reality, seeing all beings in a great direct flush of reality and knowing they can be freed and knowing the way to free them. And this is later, it was later talked about as well with the vision of lotuses. He saw all beings like lotuses emerging from the mud of existence. And then again, when we see that kind of, when the Buddha, see that Buddha's vision about all humanity, we can really understand that phrase, may they progress. We want people to progress because they are lotuses emerging from the mud of existence. Because they can be free. All beings can be free. And I think it's very important that we get that kind of idea of the Buddha's, or sense of the Buddha's vision of humanity, because it gets us away from this idea that metta is deserved, that you deserve metta because you are good. Well, you don't deserve metta because you're good, because what if you're horrid? Does that mean that, like, you know, you don't deserve metta anymore? Well, what an impoverished vision of existence, that I only deserve metta because I'm good, because I know quite well how foul I can be. So it's nothing to do with that. Yeah, it's nothing to do with being good. You deserve metta, we deserve metta, because we are part of life and because we have the potential for Buddhahood. And because we are growing, living human beings. And there's no deserving it because you're so skillful or something. Yeah, so we are all part of life. And just as others are not fixed or separate, neither are we. We are not fixed or separate. And just as much as it's not a case of anyone else deserving metta because they've been good and so nice to us, it's not a question of ourselves deserving metta because we're so good and nice. And if you ever forget that, maybe bring to mind how the Buddha would see you. He would just see you as part of life, the whole flux of life, as a human being struggling with their existence, trying to bring into being metta and mindfulness with the potential to Buddhahood. So yes, so we can't fix anyone, we can't fix ourselves, we can't say that this person is like this or like that. Everyone is always unique, everyone is mysterious, everyone is a momentary crystallization of conditions, and everyone is beautiful. And they're beautiful not because they're good, or because they've done the right thing, or because they're such lovely, nice Buddhists, or they're nice people or something. People are beautiful because they're growing, they're living, growing human beings. And because we know that growth, because we resonate with that life in them, because we have that life in us. So Subhuti calls this stage a direct recognition of the same life in the beings around one that one knows in oneself. So that's why we have metta for someone in this stage, because they're living, growing, changing human beings. And we know they're living, growing, changing human beings because we ourselves are living and growing and changing with the potential for Buddhahood. So in the poem that I quoted, Czesław Miłosz says, "Then one wants to use oneself and things so that they stand in the glow of ripeness." So in a way, this is where how metta is turned into a desire for the well-being of others. We want all beings to stand in the glow of ripeness, to ripen their own Buddha potential. So sort of practically, when we do the metta bhavana, the way that we could focus on this is to, when we bring someone to mind, we could listen out for the stories about someone that we're creating. You know, so this person is like this, or this person is like that. We could listen for those stories. And we could ask ourselves, is that true? Is that true? Do you really know who that person is? Do you really know who you are? Maybe it's just a generalization based on sort of shaky evidence. And instead of focusing on those stories, we could focus on their impermanence, their mystery, their beauty. We could just stand back and contemplate and say, may they progress, may they progress. And look for stories of separation. Look for those stories that say, I'm different from that person. Well, is there any difference between us? And if there is some difference between us, what is that difference? In what does that difference consist? So that's actually Bhante's advice in Living with Kindness on making in metta and insight practice. He says, ask yourself, is there any difference between us? And if there is any difference, well, in what does that difference consist? Undermine your own stories, your own fixed stories about other people and about yourselves. But there's still further to go. There's still further to go than beauty. There's this stage of non-objectified Maitri. So Bhante says about this, finally, this scientific approach gives way to a mode of behaving and functioning skillfully that is quite spontaneous, based on no conceptual rationale whatsoever. So at this point, we remove all justifications, we remove all conceptualizations about why to practice metta and about who it is who is practicing metta and who we are practicing metta towards. But we just love beings because we are full of love. It's not even at this point an emotion in the proper sense. There's no subject and there's no object. It's the stage that Bhante has called free-floating metta, spontaneous compassionate activity, no subject, no object. And in a way, I can't really say much about this. I'm going to leave it to bigger people, like Padmasambhava. So Padmasambhava says, you can see that all beings, both self and others, have the nature of openness. Free from intellectualization, they are like the sky. From that knowledge, love grows continuously like a ceaseless melody. Love projects itself as open-ended with no set nature, with no limited focus, and being non-conceptual in its being, it exhibits the purity of body, speech, and mind. Thus, love is transformed into compassion. So again, very beautiful imagery. Love grows continuously like a ceaseless melody. And Bhante says, to speak of oneself at this stage is almost a contradiction in terms. Just as a circle that has expanded into infinity is not really a circle anymore, so the mind that has expanded to embrace all beings has gone beyond definition. Forgetting the self as a reference point, no longer asking what any given situation means for you alone, the self is replaced by a creative orientation of becoming. There is metta broken loose from anybody who develops or experiences metta. There is mind set free or liberated from any actually perceiving or percipient subject. There is light, to speak more symbolically, that doesn't come from any particular source, but which is everywhere. So yes, this self is replaced by a creative orientation of becoming. So it doesn't mean that one self is denied or suppressed in any way. It's actually that you become so big, there's no sort of centre, like a circle that's expanded indefinitely. Light, so to speak, that doesn't come from any particular source, but which is everywhere. So we no longer think of ourselves, that creative orientation of becoming means we no longer think of ourselves as sending metta or cultivating metta, we're just part of it. In the Akshayamati Nadesha, there's this wonderful passage actually where he goes through all the perfections and he says, I am not supported by the perfections, but they are so by me. So it's a bit like I am not supported by metta, I am supporting metta. Metta is not my helper, I help metta. And I think this is the kind of shift in consciousness, that one sees oneself as part of a creative orientation of becoming. One sees oneself as part of a kind of force of goodness in the world. And one just has to serve that force. And it's not even that at this point we're surrendering our own needs. We're actually just becoming part of metta, which fills us. So it's not that you lose your own individuality, it's just you're part of something much, much bigger than your individuality. There's no self-construction at all. And this, of course, is expressed in the Mahayana, in the later schools of Buddhism, as the Bodhisattva, the being of enlightenment, who helps all beings spontaneously. In a poem by Czesław Miłosz, he says, it doesn't matter whether he knows what he serves. He who serves best doesn't always understand. So he just becomes a servant to love. Some people have different ideas about being a servant or to serving or to service, but I quite like it. And maybe it's because we had this discussion on last Tirat Loka, maybe it's just because I'm quite posh. And so I see service as like a knight in shining armour serving a kind of greater master. Whereas someone in my group was seeing it being like going into service and being a maid. So, no, let's forget the maid thing. No, let's be a knight in shining armour. Like kind of Joan of Arc, serving love but not getting burnt at the stake. Anyway, so yes. But I love that line. He who serves best doesn't always understand. So we can get a glimpse of this in the Metta Bhavana, particularly in the last stage. In the last stage where we expand out to more and more people and in a way to the whole of existence, and then we stop trying and we just sit. We just sit in that sense of metta. And it's very important to stay in that sense of metta for as long as possible after meditation, to relax all effort. In the Tibetan schools they call this the visualization and completion stage. In a way the rest of the metta bhavana is led up to the just sitting. And in that just sitting, we just absorb metta. We just become part of metta. We allow metta to fill us. So those are the three phases of metta, if you like, from the Akshayamati Nadesha. And it's important that we look at this right at the beginning, even, because we have to get a sense of what we're looking for in the metta bhavana. Are we looking for a vedana, Singhamati said yesterday, as a pleasant feeling, or are we looking for a directionality of mind? And metta is a directionality of mind. It's an intention. It's what we do with our mind. It's the mental states we put our energy behind. It's an attitude rather than a feeling. And in this, the directionality of mind that we're encouraging in the metta bhavana is an expansion beyond the self as fixed and separate. It's seeing other people as human beings just as we are, who experience joy and sorrow, who want to be happy and free from suffering. And it's seeing other people as always changing and ourselves as always changing, as fundamentally beautiful and impermanent. And then it's relaxing into that open space of metta, suspending the demands of constant self-construction and seeing the world in terms of what we can get out of it. Practically, we can do this in the metta bhavana by noticing how we bring people to mind and in paying attention to how we're bringing people to mind in every stage. Singamati's touched on yesterday about the metta bhavana having an active and an receptive sort of mood or movement. So there's the active part of bringing someone to mind and how you're bringing someone to mind. And then there's being receptive to that person as a person. And being receptive to our own feelings and emotions towards that person. Yeah. So yeah, I hope some of that's been helpful on a practical level. But I suppose it's just saying that metta is an intention. It's a force. It's a challenge to greed, hatred and delusion. And as Bhante says in Living with Kindness, it's not a kindergarten practice. It can take you all the way to enlightenment. So I'll just finish with Czesław Miłosz's poem. Love means to learn to look at yourself the way one looks at distant things, for you are only one thing among many. And whoever sees this way heals his heart without knowing it from various ills. A bird and a tree say to him, friend. And then one learns to use oneself and things so that they stand in the glow of ripeness. It doesn't matter whether you know, whether he knows who he serves. Who serves best doesn't always understand.